Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
There are just a few people around who can claim to have created the digital world that we live in. Jaron Lanier, a computer scientist, is in that small club. He was an early pioneer of virtual reality, and he's an architect of what's called Web 2.0. Lanier, for much of his career, was an idealist, almost a utopian, about the promise of technology to improve our lives. He talked with Nick Thompson, the digital editor of The New Yorker, about how we actually lost some of that belief.
We believed that if you had a universal open information system, we didn't have the name internet yet, but we believed that something like that would further the cause of rational, fact-based human discourse and would reduce non-factual, fear-based fads that are used to manipulate people, with climate change denialism being a specific one. And the reason it came up is one of the major figures back then was a senator from Tennessee named Al Gore, who really did play a pivotal role in bringing about a single information service to be called the internet rather than having a bunch of incompatible ones. And at the time, he was also an early, probably the earliest political voice expressing concern for climate change. And I remember at a meeting saying, you know, these two things go together. If we can have the universal information service, people will approach these huge questions, these long-term questions like climate change, more realistically. You know, that didn't happen. That's an example of me being wrong. And it doesn't happen often that I'm wrong, but here is an example. And I think it really speaks to the way utopianism can make you a little blind, although I'm not willing to give up my utopianism completely. But I mean, the question for me is, was it completely wrong? Or did it turn out to be wrong because we made some wrong steps after that? And I currently kind of tend to believe that latter thing, that we ended up turning the internet into this giant sort of manipulation service where people pay us for what's called advertising, but it's more like behavioral manipulation. And that fork in the road is, I think, what kind of ruined it.
The fork in the road where Google started attaching advertising to search results is what made information, false information spread more easily?
Well, what it did is it created a perverse incentive for people to manipulate the population instead of present things more neutrally. Given that advertising essentially, you know, is the only source of revenue for companies like Google and Facebook at this point, obviously, there's a lot of room for manipulation there. And we're proud of it. I mean, like, we routinely, we speaking for Silicon Valley, you know, we publish sociology papers showing that we can affect people's emotions without them realizing it and that sort of thing. I think that was a wrong turn taken around the turn of the century. And it would be interesting to someday try doing the internet over with a different approach and see if that has a different result.
So where there's no advertising attached to search results, no advertising attached to the major social networks, you think that we would have ended up with an internet that, instead of sending people to misinformation, reduced misinformation?
Well, I mean, here, I was wrong once, right? So why are you asking me now? Do I have any credibility with you at all? No, look, you know, the theory, and I'm really not sure if this would work out, but the theory is that if you made it more of a network of equals, instead of the central company having more information about you than you have about that company, instead of it being an imbalanced system, if it was a balanced system, and if the economics of it was balanced, which would mean people would get paid for whatever they contribute to it, so that you had a more spread out economic benefit instead of such a concentrated one. If those two things were true, then in theory, there'd at least be a chance that there'd be more motivation for service and less motivation for manipulation online.
I want to ask you about a subject you're often asked about, which is, of course, virtual reality. We're in a moment of incredible boom in virtual reality, and you're often called the founder or one of the founders of virtual reality. Will you take us through your early contributions, your early work, and your current work?
Okay, sure. In my teens, in the 70s, I got the bug, and I was just enthralled with this notion.
Enthralled with what notion?
The notion, well, of what I came to call virtual reality, but at that time, we called them virtual worlds, and that came from Ivan Sutherland, who built the first headset for VR, which was in the 60s. What I did is I started the first commercial company. I made the first multi-user stuff. I made the first versions of a lot of the major applications in collaboration with people from those fields, including surgical simulation and kitchen design and all kinds of things over a fairly long period. And we seeded industrial and scientific labs all over the world with the initial equipment in the 80s that they were able to use to make virtual reality experiments and improve the field. I made the first avatars, I suppose.
So 30 years ago, as you start working on this, what was drawing you in? It wasn't, it seems like, to make money. What was it?
Well, I was very intensely starry-eyed back then, and I still am. So what I believed is that virtual reality represented a new frontier of human creativity and a way for people to connect with each other in new ways. And virtual reality lets you tap into parts of your brain that are otherwise hard to access. Mm-hmm. Like you might turn your avatar into a mathematical expression and then dance it through all the different phases it can take on. And mm-hmm. I know that sounds just crazy and utopian, and yet someday I'm sure it'll sound ordinary and it'll be like this ordinary pleasure, as ordinary as reading and writing are today. It's also beautiful. I mean, it's possible to create extraordinary beauty in virtual reality. And at the same time, let us not forget that in order to make virtual reality work at all, you have to measure what people are doing in great detail to make the illusion work. And that measurement gives you the opportunity to put a person in a Skinner box and manipulate them to a vastly greater degree of accuracy than you could imagine using something like Facebook today. So it has the potential for apocalyptic creepiness too, but so does any powerful technology. And we really have to go into it eyes open, virtual reality more so than most.
So we're now at this really interesting moment where virtual reality is taking off and the biggest tech companies in the world are investing heavily in it, very attached to it. What are the crucial decisions that need to be made now so that virtual reality ends up serving the common good, ends up improving us as a species?
That's a great question. And I think the number one answer is people have to own their own data. Mm-hmm. Like we have to get away from this regime where you're given a all or nothing choice, where you click this one thing and then all of your data is just taken. You don't even know what the data is. You don't know what happens to it.
And the data is how we move our heads, what we look at, how we react inside
like
the system.
As an example, it might be as you're walking down the street, who are you really attracted to? What really scares you? Like all kinds of little things that you might not even be fully aware of. Or it might be stuff that you do deliberately, whatever it is, any data that exists because you exist, you have to own it. If you want to have a lot of privacy, just set the price of your information insanely high. If you want to maximize your income, play around with the price to find the right one. And if you really just don't care, make it free. But it's your choice. Another thing it does is it creates a more enforceable ethical regime, because right now there's no transparency at all. So nobody knew the NSA was collecting data until it was leaked by somebody. How could you know? You have no way of knowing. But the interesting thing about money is that it creates this world of people called accountants. So all of a sudden, if there's money on the table, there'll be motivations for people to track it, and it'll actually make the world more transparent, not less transparent.
People need to control their data? What else? What are the other principles as we enter the era of virtual reality?
Well, I think as we get better and better at creating illusions, there should be a firm ethical and legal requirement that people are honest about when they're creating an illusion versus when they're not. You shouldn't be able to create a false position of the curb to cause somebody to walk into traffic without their own intention and put themselves at risk or something like that. Like there's a million pranks you can play with mixed reality in particular that really shouldn't be legal. That's an extreme example. You shouldn't be able to make a product look different than it is when you're thinking about buying it or something like that. Like, you know, like if you're at the store shopping, you should see the vegetables as they really are instead of through some filter that makes them look fresher or something.
And when you got into virtual reality, as you said, you wanted it to improve our imaginations, improve our cognitive processing. Do you think that's going to happen with the direction the industry is heading right now?
I think it could. Well, I'll give you a little example of that. I have a 9-year-old daughter, and I asked one of my grad students to make her a 4-dimensional world a higher kind of dimensional space that's a little hard to explain quickly and hard to imagine. But if you can have intuition in it, you could be fantastic at all kinds of math that are quite important. So I told my daughter about that, and she was like furious. Like, I had a chance to be the first four-dimensional kid, and you didn't do it. Like, what is wrong with you? Since then, she's been demanding four-dimensional experiences. So I've been giving her them. And, you know, a nine-year-old can learn to navigate in four dimensions, and it's really cool. So it's like a tangible example of something where I think we can increase human range, you know. Now, about the industry direction, there's good news and there's bad news. I think the good news is that it's driven by passion. Like, that's been true for all the commercial interests that I've seen. People just try it. And I mean, look, if you look at people with their smartphones, they sort of turn into like these stone zombies with little wiggling fingers on the glass. You look at people in VR and they're engaged, they're moving. It's a different type of experience that's just much more physical and joyous and healthy. And, you know, obviously everybody in the tech world wants things to be more like that. And that's all for the good. What's problematic is that the immediately available customer base is the gamers. And nothing wrong with games, nothing wrong with gamers overall. However, there is this sort of hardcore gamer culture that's kind of misogynistic and mean-spirited now, which is perhaps best known as the Gamergate phenomenon. Yeah. And virtual reality can inherit some of that. Now, I'm sure the broad market for VR is much bigger, but it's a little bit, if I can make a crazy metaphor, it's a little bit like the Republican primary problem, where the immediate market is kind of loony and mean-spirited, but it's the immediate one that you get through. So it kind of tilts and focuses the whole thing in its own direction. The gamer culture isn't the only one feeding into VR. There's another very interesting one coming from cinema. Personally, a lot of the work from that side of the aisle is a little more interesting to me at this particular moment this year. But there's also some great stuff coming out of the gaming world. There really is.
Okay. Tell me a little bit more about how you've introduced your daughter to technology, what you want her to try and what you want her to stay away from.
You ask that as if I have control or sort of... I
have a 7-year-old, so I'm going through the same thing too.
Yeah, she seems to be using technology in a healthy way. She seems to use it with her friends. She seems to be alive when she uses it. Once in a while, I see her get a little zombie-like watching a video or something, and that's when I sort of intervene. I don't think it's good to have kids fall into that. Mm-hmm. I will say that in the technical elite, you do tend to see... I know a lot of people in the industry with kids in Waldorf schools that are zero technology zones. Mm-hmm. I think... We tend to look at people with Facebook accounts as chumps by this point, and we don't want our own kids to fall into it. But the irony, of course, is they will.
Jaron, can you quickly explain what the fourth dimension is as your daughter uses and understands it?
Okay. So look, if you imagine in the real world, you can tell where something is with just three numbers. Well, it's three to the left and four down from the ceiling and five units away from me, whatever those units might be. So just three numbers is enough to position something. So there's a lot of instances in math where you need to have another number to describe where things are, where they poke into this other dimension that we don't experience, where there's just this other number that describes where things are. And we need that in order to describe all of modern physics. And it is a little hard to get it across at first. And it will not be in virtual reality. If we were in a virtual world, I would just show you and you'd get it just like that. And I think you'd derive great pleasure from that. And I'm sorry, radio just can't do that.
Soon our radio show will be in the fourth dimension, Jaron, so it'll be fine.
Well, when your radio show moves to VR, invite me back and then I'll show you.
I look forward to it. Thank you, Jaron Lanier, for coming on. It was a pleasure to talk with you.
Oh, sure. Great.
Jaron Lanier, computer scientist and the author of books including Who Owns the Future? He spoke with the editor of NewYorker.com, Nick Thompson.